This is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Allison Stewart. On the show, we feature a number of TED Talks, where a speaker shares a powerful idea with an audience gathered at a TED conference. Today, we have lots of big ideas about food.
I think we have this whole eating thing wrong.
It's largely processed and full of all sorts of additives, extra ingredients, and you know the rest of the story.
We can look to the next 30 years as a time to change the food system again.
We're not born craving Whoppers or Skittles.
Sustainability is complicated, but dinner is a reality that we all very much understand.
Flavor is king. Flavor rules. We can take the food we need from the earth and actually heal the earth in the process.
Fats, carbs, proteins, they weren't bad or good. They were food. You ate food.
It can be farm fresh or takeout, served on a white linen tablecloth or out of a can. But whatever's on the menu, the way we grow, transport, market, and consume our food has far larger implications beyond what's on our plates. Our guests today offer up some big ideas about food, like how to save our crops, how to save our kids from unhealthy school lunches, and how to save ourselves from bad flavor. Let's begin with this question. Just what does it take for a city to feed itself?
When you think that every day for a city the size of London, enough food has to be produced, transported, bought and sold, cooked, eaten, disposed of, and that something similar has to happen every day for every city on Earth, it's remarkable that cities get fed at all.
I'm Carolyn Steele, and my TED Talk was about how food shapes cities.
Carolyn Steele isn't a chef, nutritionist, or even a food writer. She's actually an architect, fascinated with the relationship between what we eat and where we live. We'll talk with Carolyn in a moment. First, let's listen to her 2009 TED Talk, where she explains the ancient link between food and cities.
About 10,000 years ago, I would say, is the beginning of this process in the ancient Near East, known as the Fertile Crescent. And it was here about 10,000 years ago that two extraordinary inventions, agriculture and urbanism, happened roughly in the same place and at the same time. And this is no accident, because agriculture and cities are bound together. They need each other. Because it was the discovery of grain by our ancient ancestors for the first time produced a food source that was large enough and stable enough to support permanent settlements. And if we look at what those settlements were like, we see they were compact, they were surrounded by productive farmland and dominated by large temple complexes that were in fact effectively spiritualized central food distribution centres, because it was the temples that organised the harvest, gathered in the grain, offered it to the gods, and then offered the grain that the gods didn't eat back to the people. So, if you like, the whole spiritual and physical life of these cities was dominated by the grain and the harvest that sustained them. And in fact, that's true of every ancient city. But of course, not all of them were that small. Famously, Rome had about 1 million citizens by the first century AD. So how did a city like this feed itself? Basically, Rome had access to the sea, which made it possible for it to import food from a very long way away. This is the only way it was possible to do this in the ancient world, because it was very difficult to transport food over roads, which were rough, and the food obviously went off very quickly. So Rome effectively waged war on places like Carthage and Egypt just to get its paws on their grain reserves. And in fact, you could say that the expansion of the empire was really a sort of one long, drawn-out, militarised shopping spree, really. In fact, I love the fact, I just have to mention this, that Rome, in fact, used to import oysters from London at one stage. I think that's extraordinary. Anyway, so Rome shaped its hinterland through its appetite.
Carolyn Steele is joining us from London, talking about how food shapes our cities. And Carolyn, like all good architects, you brought maps to your TED Talk. And one of the maps shows a 17th century London. And it's really incredible, because it's a really wonderful visual, because you can actually see how the pathways and the way food came into the city truly carved up the city.
I just took this fabulous map. It's called the Ogilby map. It was drawn in 1676, which is 10 years after the Great Fire of London. And it's the first accurate survey of London. So it's just beautifully detailed and a huge amount of information on it. And what I did was I plotted onto that map how food was coming into the city. So I was literally reading historical records of the way the food was transported and so on. So, of course, in London, you can see the grain arriving at the grain ports. And then as the grain was arriving, it was immediately traded. So it was traded at the river ports and also the streets leading up into the middle of the city. So Bread Street tells you, you know, that literally you can see from the names of the streets that, you know, bread was being bought and sold on that street as well. So the streets leading up from the grain ports to the centre of the city became bread and grain markets.
And in fact, if you look at the map of any city built before the industrial age, you can trace food coming into it. You can actually see how it was physically shaped by food, both by reading the names of the streets, which give you a lot of clues. Friday Street on the previous slide was where you went to buy your fish on a Friday. But also you have to imagine it full of food, because the streets and the public spaces were the only places where food was bought and sold.
There's a line in your talk that I want to read. This is another thing about food in cities. Once its roots into the city are established, they very rarely move. Why is that?
This is a really interesting one. And I mean, I guess it goes to the heart of the food problem, if you like, which is that you can't kind of sit around a table and say, look, guys, you know, the food system's terrible, it doesn't work well, let's just bin it and get another one. You know, because the food has to keep coming. And if you think about food as a flow, it's the most important flow in the city. And if you think of it literally carving its own direction, you know, like a river in a landscape, they're established, they're very, very difficult to shift.
They may be hard to shift, but they do transform. During your TED talk, you showed an image of the Great Western, which changed London's relationship with food. Before we get back to your talk, can you quickly explain what the Great Western is?
It was one of the first railways built anywhere in the world, and it's a very famous railway. It joined London up to the West Country. But that particular image, I just love it because it's from 1840, so it's very, very early. And it shows that, you know, the railway is actually carrying pigs and sheep. In other words, farm animals are being transported. They're no longer walking into the city.
They're being slaughtered out of sight and mind somewhere in the countryside, and they're coming into the city by rail. And this changes everything. To start off with, it makes it possible for the first time to grow cities, really any size and shape in any place. Cities used to be constrained by geography. They used to have to get their food through very difficult physical means. All of a sudden, they're effectively emancipated from geography. And as you can see from these maps of London in the 90 years after the trains came, it goes from being a little blob that it was quite easy to feed by animals coming in on foot and so on, to a large splurge that it would be very, very difficult to feed with anybody on foot, either animals or people. And of course, that was just the beginning. After the trains came cars. And really, this marks the end of this process. It's the final emancipation of the city from any apparent relationship with nature at all. And this is a kind of city that's devoid of smell, devoid of mess, certainly devoid of people, because nobody would have dreamt of walking in such a landscape. In fact, what they did to get food was they got in their cars, drove to a box somewhere on the outskirts, came back with a week's worth of shopping, and wondered what on earth to do with it. And this really is the moment when our relationship both with food and cities changes completely. Here we have food that used to be the centre of the social core of the city at the periphery. We used to cook, now we just add water or, a little bit of an egg if you're making a cake or something. We don't smell food to see if it's okay to eat. We just read the back of a label on a packet. And we don't value food. We don't trust it. So instead of trusting it, we fear it, and instead of valuing it, we throw it away. One of the great ironies of modern food systems is that they've made the very thing they promised to make easier much harder. By making it possible to build cities anywhere in any place, they've actually distanced us from our most important relationship, which is that of us and nature. And also they've made us dependent on systems that only they can deliver that, as we've seen, are unsustainable.
Carolyn, how has anonymity changed our relationship to food and to the people who produce our food? Once upon a time, you probably knew the person who planted the carrots, and you might even have known the name of the pig that you were going to eat.
You almost certainly would have known the pig because most city dwellers kept their own pigs and their own chickens. So, yes, they wouldn't have given it a name like, you know, Pinky or Perky. No, I mean, you're absolutely right. And I think there are two very, very key things that it's important to remember about our relationship with food now. One is that what industrialisation did was it dehumanised the food chain. You know, it's even removed people from the stage where you eat the food. In other words, a lot of us now just shove food down our throats, you know, on our own while we're on our way to something more important, rather than sitting around a table and celebrating the fact that we're eating together. And I think, you know, our sort of transference of buying food from somebody that we trust and we know by face and by name to relying on brands is a very, very interesting transition, and obviously one that's now taking the planet over, because that is now what we trust, is the brands that have sold themselves to us as trustworthy in that way.
Can you describe the final image you used in your TED Talk?
This will be the Lorenzetti Allegory of the Effects of Good Government, which is an absolutely incredible fresco that was painted in 1338. And what it shows is the city and the countryside. And basically the message is,
if the city looks after the country will look after the city. And I want us to ask now, what would Ambrogio Lorenzetti paint if he painted this image today? What would an allegory of good government look like today? Because I think it's an urgent question. It's one we have to ask and we have to start answering. We know we are what we eat. We need to realise that the world is also what we eat. But if we take that idea, we can use food as a really powerful tool to shape the world better. Thank you very much.
Carolyn Steele, thank you so much for joining us on the TED Radio Hour.
It's been a great pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Carolyn Steele is an architect and author of Hungry City. You can watch her TED Talk and dozens of others about food. Go to TED.com. Coming up, there was a time when Chef Ann Cooper didn't think about what kids ate at all.
Chef, there's a screaming child on table 19. What do I do? And I'd always say, ask them to leave. Why are they in my restaurant?
These days, she's in the cafeteria at 4 a.m. cooking healthy meals for students. Tales of a renegade lunch lady. Stay tuned. You're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. This is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Allison Stewart. Each year, TED conferences bring together the world's most innovative doers and thinkers who share some big ideas from the stage. On our program, we'll hear a number of their TED Talks, and then we'll talk to them. And today, we're talking about food.
We have our 500-degree oven.
And slice these real, real thin.
One slice red onion.
Pickles, onions, mustard.
Brown it up, crisp it up.
Turn it over.
We're going to let it cook, then we're going to let it cool down.
And just set it aside.
Now we're going to add
a half a cup of all-purpose flour.
Two to three eggs.
And half a teaspoon of salt.
I'm just going to mix that together.
To go into the oven.
Voila!
Okay, who's next?
I raised these myself. I picked them last night, and they're real good.
Local farmers come to Washington, D.C.'s Eastern Market every weekend to sell all sorts of colorful produce.
We have York apples right here. I have a Fuji apple right there. Nitsni, Golden Delicious, Cameo, and I have a yellow Asian pear.
That probably sounds like enough choices to keep anyone happy. But for every variety of fruit and vegetable on sale here, there are several thousands more that are now extinct.
My name is Carrie Fowler, and I'm the executive director of the Global Crop Diversity Trust, based in Rome, Italy. The TED Talk was about crop diversity and about the importance of conserving that diversity as the foundation of agriculture and the future of agriculture.
Carrie Fowler knows that crop diversity isn't exactly a hot-button topic, but to him, it's every bit as urgent as climate change or world hunger, and entirely connected. We'll talk with Carrie in just a few minutes. But first, let's listen to some of his 2009 TED Talk, where he warns about the crumbling base of agriculture.
We have about 200,000 different varieties of wheat, and we have about 200,000 to 400,000 different varieties of rice, but it's being lost. And I want to give you an example of that. It's a bit of a personal example, in fact.
In the United States in the 1800s, that's where we have the best data, farmers and gardeners were growing 7,100 named varieties of apples. Imagine that, 7,100 apples with names. Today, 6,800 of those are extinct, no longer to be seen again. I used to have a list of these extinct apples, and when I would go out and give a presentation, I would pass the list out in the audience. I wouldn't tell them what it was, but it was in alphabetical order. And I would tell them to look for their names, their family names, their mother's maiden name. And at the end of the speech, I would ask, how many people have found a name? And I had never had fewer than 2/3 of an audience hold up their hand. And I said, you know what? These apples come from your ancestors. And your ancestors gave them the greatest honor they could give them. They gave them their name. The bad news is they're extinct. The good news is a third of you didn't hold up your hand. Your apple's still out there. Find it. Make sure it doesn't join the list.
Now, Carrie, the name of your TED Talk is One Seed at a Time, Protecting the Future of Food. And you make this case that preserving diversity of crops is important, but want to be clear for the audience that you're talking about a lot more serious considerations than just having choice in flavor or textures. What do you believe is the true reason we need diversity?
Well, absolutely. It's not just important. It's absolutely essential. If we don't have diversity in our agricultural crops, or backing up those agricultural crops, then the crops themselves, which are domesticated plants, don't have the ability to evolve and to adapt to new conditions. So, for example, most of us will go in the grocery store, pick up a loaf of bread, and the loaf of bread tastes pretty much the way it did many years ago. But I can promise you that it's being made with different varieties of wheat and has to be made with different varieties of wheat because pests and diseases are always changing. They're getting better at attacking the wheat in the field. And the climates are changing. So how do we make those different varieties that can keep up with all the environmental pressures?
Carrie, let's get back to your TED Talk.
I get this question all the time. Why don't we just save the best one? And there are a couple of answers to that question. One thing is that there is no such thing as a best one. Today's best variety is tomorrow's lunch for an insect or a pest or disease. The other thing is, maybe a variety of wheat that's not economical right now has disease or pest resistance or some quality that we're going to need for climate change that the others don't. It's just necessary or interesting that it might have one good, unique trait. And for that reason, we ought to be saving it. Why? As a raw material, as a trait that we can use in the future. Think of diversity as giving us options. And options, of course, are exactly what we need in an era of climate change.
When did it become clear that agrodiversity was being threatened?
It became clear first in the 1930s and early 40s when scientists back in those days realized that we were using up these genetic resources, these heirloom old varieties of crops, and we were using them to create modern varieties, but the modern varieties themselves were sort of destroying the old varieties. So we were a sort of a snake eating its tail, if you will. We were engaged in a very unsustainable activity. Unfortunately, of course, that unsustainable activity happens to be agriculture, which is feeding us.
So now you offer some good news, which is that scientists like yourself have been saving all different types of seeds in seed banks, which are basically like freezers. You found the perfect place for a global seed bank, which you described in your TED Talk. Let's listen.
So a number of us got together and decided that, you know, enough is enough, and we need to do something about that, and we need to have a facility that can really offer protection for our biological diversity of maybe not the most charismatic diversity. You don't look in the eyes of a carrot seed quite in the way that you do a panda bear, but it's very important diversity. So we needed a really safe place, and we went quite far north to find it. to Svalbard, in fact. This is above mainland Norway. You can see Greenland there. That's at 78 degrees north. It's as far as you can fly on a regularly scheduled airplane. We worked with the Norwegian government and with the NorGen, the Norwegian Genetic Resources Program, to design this facility, which is built in a mountain in Svalbard. The idea of Svalbard was that it's cold, so we get natural freezing temperatures, but it's remote. It's remote and accessible, so it's safe, and we don't depend on mechanical refrigeration.
There is a very funny, genuine moment in your TED Talk when you discuss that being in the seed bank were some of the happiest times in your life. You have great joy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Why does being in the seed bank bring you that much joy?
For me, it's an emotionally powerful place. We've faced a mass extinction in our agricultural system just in our lifetime, with so much diversity being lost forever, like the dinosaurs in a way. And this diversity is the foundation of food security forever and ever. But when I walk back in the seed vault, gosh, I see 750,000 unique varieties, 140,000 different varieties of rice, for example, that I'm pretty sure are not going to go extinct. So all of those traits and characteristics that those varieties have that I'm sure are going to be needed in the future to help us have a good agricultural system adapted to climate change, they're not in danger.
I think it's interesting in that this facility, I think, is almost the only thing I can think of these days where countries, literally every country in the world, because we have seeds from every country in the world, all the countries of the world have gotten together to do something that's both long-term, sustainable, and positive. I can't think of anything else that's happened in my lifetime that way.
Kerry, one of the things about you and your organization, the Global Crop Diversity Trust, that I think is really moving is how optimistic you are. Why are you so optimistic?
Well, I think we can achieve it. When I look at what we're doing, I realize, well, gosh, you know, this diversity that we want to save has somehow made it all this way from the origins of agriculture in the Neolithic days down to this year, this planting season. And all we have to do is conserve it for future generations, which we can do pretty easily. We have the technology. It's not to be invented. It's currently there. And if we can manage to do that, it will actually serve as it's a prerequisite, actually, for solving a lot of these other problems.
I can't look you in the eyes and tell you that I have a solution for climate change, for the water crisis. Agriculture takes 70% of fresh water supplies on Earth. I can't look you in the eyes and tell you that there is such a solution for those things, or the energy crisis, or world hunger, or peace and conflict. I can't look you in the eyes and tell you that I have a simple solution for that. But I can look you in the eyes and tell you that we can't solve any of those problems if we don't have crop diversity. Because I challenge you to think of an effective, efficient, sustainable solution to climate change if we don't have crop diversity. Because quite literally, if agriculture doesn't adapt to climate change, neither will we. And if crops don't adapt to climate change, neither will agriculture, neither will we. And my final thought is that we, of course, by conserving wheat, rice, potatoes, and the other crops, we may quite simply end up saving ourselves. Thank you.
You can read more about Kerry's work and see pictures of the Svalbard Global Seed Vault. Go to ted.npr.org. In a typical day, in a typical lunchroom, there is some kid chowing down on pizza or chicken fingers, maybe some French fries. It's likely been reheated after it was thawed out. Chef Ann Cooper wants to change that.
And what I came to understand is we needed to teach children the symbiotic relationship between a healthy planet, healthy food, and healthy kids. And that if we don't do that, the antithesis is we're really going to become extinct because we're feeding our children to death.
Ann Cooper is currently director of nutritional services for the Boulder Valley School District in Boulder, Colorado. And she joins us now. Ann Cooper, welcome to the TED Radio Hour.
Thank you for having me here.
Once upon a time, you were just a regular old chef. What kind of chef were you?
I don't know. I think I was a pretty good chef. I actually cooked all over this country. I cooked overseas. I was on cruise ships. I opened a restaurant in London. And then I just thought, what if I could take all of that and really give back? And maybe I just need to do something different. So in 1999, I left the chef world to become a lunch lady.
I hope you know when I said regular old chef, I meant that tongue in cheek.
I know.
Now, you worked in the Berkeley school system. And, you know, Berkeley has a reputation for being progressive and sort of crunchy. But you found that they weren't so progressive when it came to school lunches. Tell me what you found when you first started working with the system.
Well, when I first went to Berkeley, I thought, oh, this is Alice Waters' hometown. You know, she works for the school district. Everything's going to be amazing. But when I got there, I looked at the food and almost everything was processed and packaged. And it was a cycle menu of chicken nuggets with tater tots and high fructose corn syrup and pizza pockets and corn dogs and extremo burritos and grilled cheese sandwiches, and everything was pre-made and served in plastic, heated in plastic, came in plastic. And that's really what the food was when I got there.
What was the explanation for why the service and the food was as it was at Berkeley?
It's not what Berkeley did or even what Boulder was doing before I came here, but it's what everyone's been doing. The National School Lunch Program started about 65 years ago. And when it started, it was lunch ladies, and seriously, mostly women, were cooking what I'm assuming was really just simple food, but they were cooking. There was no processed foods, no TV dinners, nothing about 65 years ago. And then 30 years into the program, those original lunch ladies and all their equipment needed to be retired. And so big business went to schools and said, oh, you don't need to replace your equipment. You don't need to replace your cooks. Here, we have chicken nuggets that just need to be warmed. Or here, we have tater tots. And so school districts all over the country were really starting to switch from having food that was cooked to these processed foods that were easy to serve and quote-unquote safe and never touched by human hands. And it was really what was happening for more than a couple of decades until in the last, you know, 5 years, 10 years, we've seen it start to slowly move back to cooking food again.
When you first went into the school system to try to change the lunchroom menu, what was the one change you made that you think really changed people's attitudes?
You know, I think that the biggest change right away, both in Berkeley and in Boulder, was putting in salad bars. When people could actually see fresh fruits, fresh vegetables, whole grains, healthy proteins, really see salad bars, see kids eating salads, I think that that was a wonderful first step in trying to make people understand that it shouldn't be about chicken nuggets and tater tots and chocolate milk.
I know one of your most creative and controversial, to some, suggestion is to take the food program out of the hands of the USDA and give it to the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control. Now, if you look up food on the CDC's website, it's mostly about an after-the-fact position, response to foodborne diseases, and it advocates food safety. Now, what do you think the CDC could do that the USDA isn't doing, in your opinion?
Well, whether it would be CDC or maybe HHS, Health and Human Services, I just think we have to see school lunch as a health initiative. I mean, we're now seeing 3/4 of Americans overweight or obese, 1/3 of kids, school-age kids, overweight or obese. And if we believe that everything that happens in a school is part of the educational experience, then we have to think that school lunch is training our kids and teaching and educating our kids to eat in a certain way. So I just believe that if school lunch was seen as part of health, that we would have better food.
The work you do, does it cost as much, less, or more than the current system in most schools in the United States?
It costs more. The USDA reimbursement rate for school lunch is $2.77, and it's costing us over $3 to put out a lunch. And I think that that's very typical in most schools. Most directors will tell you that, you know, there's not enough money in the system. We need more money in the system to feed kids better food. That being said, I think if we did get more money, it should go directly to the cost of the food, to procuring fresh foods, fresh vegetables, whole grains, healthy protein, with a priority on local procurement.
Marketing is so important. How do you make healthy lunches as attractive as a burger in a box with fries and maybe a toy?
Well, I'm not sure how you go up against that kind of marketing. But one of the things we do is market to kids all the time. We do tastings, rainbow days, chef demos, and Iron Chef competitions. We work with the kids all the time. If we want to change children's relationship to food, they have to be part of the process. And so we do a lot of events with them. And another thing that we really do is work with school gardens. Because if kids are part of the process, they start to understand what real food is.
Ann Cooper, good luck with your good work.
Thank you.
Ann Cooper is Director of Nutritional Services for the Boulder Valley School District in Boulder, Colorado. You can watch her 2007 talk on school nutrition. Go to TED.com. Coming up, Chef Dan Barber fell in love with a fish until he found out some unforgiving details.
I sliced and put it in my mouth, and I was just like, wow, I can never eat this again.
That breakup led him to meet the new love of his life. That story just ahead. You're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. This is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Allison Stewart.
Pig, very rare. New cobia, one medium well, one medium. Pepper wheat Russell.
At Blue Hill Restaurant in New York City, the food is fresh from nearby farms.
Guys, just give me the tutu, lettuce salad, and we do the pasta, beef burger, spring salad.
Yes!
It's a celebration of local agriculture. The menu is a bounty of organic vegetables and proteins.
My name is Dan Barber. I'm the chef and co-owner of Blue Hill and Blue Hill at Stone Barns.
Dan is very conscious about the integrity of the ingredients that go into his dishes, which makes his story all the more interesting. We'll be talking to Dan in just a few minutes, but let's start with the beginning of his 2010 TED Talk, where he made a peculiar confession.
I've known a lot of fish in my life. I've loved only two. That first one was, it was more like a passionate affair. It was a beautiful fish, flavorful, textured, meaty, a bestseller on the menu. What a fish. Even better, it was farm-raised to the supposed highest standards of sustainability, so you could feel good about selling it. One day, the head of the company called and asked if I'd speak at an event about the farm's sustainability. Absolutely, I said. Here was a company trying to solve what's become this unimaginable problem for us chefs. How do we keep fish on our menus? For the past 50 years, we've been fishing the seas like we clear-cut forests. It's hard to overstate the destruction. 90% of large fish, the ones we love, the tunas, the halibuts, the salmons, swordfish, they've collapsed. There's almost nothing left. So for better or for worse, aquaculture, fish farming, it's going to be part of our future. A lot of arguments against it. Fish farms pollute. Most of them do anyway. And they're inefficient. So here, finally, was a company trying to do it right. I wanted to support them.
The day before the event, Dan put in a call to the company's PR person to get some talking points. So he asked, what do you feed your fish? The answer? Sustainable proteins.
And that night, I was lying in bed, and I thought, what the hell is a sustainable protein? So the next day, just before the event, I called Don. I said, Don, what are some examples of sustainable proteins? He said he didn't know. He would ask around. Well, I got on the phone with a few people in the company. No one could give me a straight answer. Until finally, I got on the phone with the head biologist. Let's call him Don, too. Don, I said, what are some examples of sustainable proteins? Well, he mentioned some algaes and some fish meals, and then he said chicken pellets. I said, chicken pellets? He said, yeah, feathers, skin, bone meal, scraps, dried and processed into feed. I said, what percentage of your feed is chicken? Thinking, you know, 2%. Oh, it's about 30%, he said. I said, Don, what's sustainable about feeding chicken to fish? There was a long pause on the line. And he said, there's just too much chicken in the world. Okay, I fell out of love with this fish. Now, not because I'm some self-righteous goody-two-shoes foodie. I actually am. Now, I fell out of love with this fish because I swear to God, after that conversation, the fish tasted like chicken.
That's the big laugh line, and I can't let that last line go without asking. Did it actually taste like chicken, or was it the idea so disgustingly memorable that you
That's the question. Do we think we're tasting something or we're actually tasting it? I do remember the afternoon, the early evening that this happened. I mean, it was one moment where I had just had this conversation with Don, and it was a very, very warm evening, and the kitchen was just sort of impossibly hot. And so I remember reaching over to where we prepare raw fish, and there it was on the board. And I just remember, because of the heat, I was sweating terribly. All the cooks were sweating terribly, but it's sort of like the fish was sweating. And it just had this like sliminess feel to it. And it was just a day after the conversation with Don. So I sliced and put it in my mouth, and I was just like, wow, I can never eat this again. And that was it. That was the end of my relationship with that fish and with the company.
After hearing the story, it made me think, okay, Dan Barber is so knowledgeable about this. This is his business. He's passionate about this. He's an advocate. And even he ended up not making a good choice.
Yeah.
So me and everybody
exactly
else,
right,
as a normal person, yeah, it's so overwhelming. Like, how am I supposed to? Is it farm? Is it not? Yeah. Do I tune a dolphin? What?
It's such a great question because it's humbling, because I spend my life thinking about what my tomato's eating or what, you know, the lamb is eating, what chicken's eating. I never thought about what the fish is being fed, which is just crazy. But I think it's instructive in the larger sense, and I think you're right to zero in on it, because what I learned from this lesson, if there's a sort of ultimate lesson in this whole story of Don and his company, is that we eaters, chefs, should really be guided by great flavor. Because when we're guided by great flavor, truly, truly great flavor, not what a company will tell you is great flavor, but truly deliciousness, you end up supporting the right kind of fish farming.
We're here with Chef Dan Barber talking about his 2010 TED Talk. And we should remind listeners, this is a story about falling in love with two different fish. We just heard about the first. Now let's go back to your TED Talk and hear about the second.
This second fish, well, it's a different kind of love story. It's the romantic kind. The kind where the more you get to know your fish, you love the fish. I first ate it at a restaurant in southern Spain. A journalist friend had been talking about this fish for a long time. She kind of set us up. Okay, it came to the table, a bright, almost shimmering white color. The chef had overcooked it. Like twice over. Okay. Amazingly, it was still delicious. Who can make a fish taste good after it's been overcooked? I can't. But this guy can. Let's call him Miguel. Actually, his name is Miguel. And no, he didn't cook the fish, and he's not a chef, at least in the way that you and I understand it. He's a biologist at Veta La Palma. It's a fish farm in the southwestern corner of Spain. It's at the tip of the Guadalquivir River. Until the 1980s, the farm was in the hands of the Argentinians. They raised beef cattle on what was essentially wetlands. They did it by draining the land They built this intricate series of canals, and they pushed water off the land and out into the river. Well, they couldn't make it work, not economically. And ecologically, it was a disaster. Killed like 90% of the birds, which for this place is a lot of birds. And so in 1982, a Spanish company with an environmental conscience purchased the land. What did they do? They reversed the flow of water. They literally flipped the switch. Instead of pushing water out, they used the channels to pull water back in. They flooded the canals. They created a 27,000-acre fish farm. Bass, mullet, shrimp, eel. And in the process, Miguel and this company completely reversed the ecological destruction.
You went to visit Miguel on the farm, and he gave you a tour and explained how it all works. Let's listen.
So I interrupted him. I said, Miguel, what makes your fish taste so good? He pointed at the algae. I know, dude, the algae, the phytoplankton, the relationships, it's amazing. Right? But what are your fish eating? And what's the feed conversion ratio? Well, he goes on to tell me, it's such a rich system that the fish are eating what they'd be eating in the wild. The plant biomass, the phytoplankton, the zooplankton, it's what feeds the fish. The system is so healthy, it's totally self-renewing. There is no feed. Ever heard of a farm that doesn't feed its animals? Later that day, I was driving around this property with Miguel, and I asked him, I said, for a place that seems so natural, unlike any fish, unlike any farm I'd ever been at, how do you measure success? Well, at that moment, it's as if a film director called for a set change, and we rounded the corner and saw the most amazing sight, thousands and thousands of pink flamingos. A literal pink carpet for as far as you could see. That's success, he said. Look at their bellies, pink. They're feasting. Feasting. I was totally confused. I said, Miguel, aren't they feasting on your fish? Yes, he said. We lose 20% of our fish and fish eggs to birds. All right, well, last year, this property had 600,000 birds on it. More than 250 different species. It's become today the largest and one of the most important private bird sanctuaries in all of Europe. I said, Miguel, isn't a thriving bird population like the last thing you want on a fish farm? He shook his head. No, he said, we farm extensively, not intensively. This is an ecological network. The flamingos eat the shrimp eat the phytoplankton. So the pinker the belly, the better the system.
Something I'm interested about Miguel's farm fishing career, is this the way he's always done it, or did he arrive at this methodology because he was involved in farming that he didn't like the practices?
Yeah, no, he actually had never farmed fish before, which I found that amazing. He was a researcher in Africa in the Mukumbi National Park, and
wow.
He studied zebras and their mating practices for many, many, many years. I asked him, what was your training in fish? And he said, I've never examined fish before. I knew nothing about fish. I am an expert on relationships because it's in the ecology, it's in the relationships that one produces the most delicious food and the most sustainable. You know, that to me was the moment of clairvoyance in this whole thing. You're not raising fish. You're raising fish as part of an overall system of health. And without the overall ecological health of the farm, then the fish aren't going to be healthy. And that's why the flamingos, which are really a predator to this whole system, are actually looked at as part of the health of the system. And that's a whole different way of thinking about really everything that we as Americans think about, which is, you know, intensity, efficiency. You know, nature is not efficient. It's quite inefficient. And it's built that way in part because that's what gives it its resiliency and its ecological health. And we have to think about that if we really want great flavor for the future.
There's one line from your TED Talk, Dan, that keeps sticking out to me. Let's hear it.
What we need now is a radically new conception of agriculture, one in which the food actually tastes good.
What do you consider radical?
Well, I would consider radical this idea of ecological thinking, that we can no longer afford an industrial application to farming, which is inputs in and what we want farmed out. Most of the food we eat is mired in that kind of mindset, and that's quite unfortunate. We're seeing the unfortunate consequences on the effects on the environment. I'm talking, and I think chefs are talking in general, about the effects on how food tastes, because it never has produced delicious food, and it never will. So we need to move out of this industrial paradigm, this, again, inputs in and food out, and look more at this ecological, at the relationships between what makes food truly delicious. And that's both very simple and quite radical, because it's radical in the sense that we have a long way to go, and I think we need to look to people like Miguel to get there.
We're not realists, us foodies. We're lovers. We love farmers markets. We love small family farms. We talk about local food. We eat organic. And when you suggest these are the things that will ensure the future of good food, someone somewhere stands up and says, "Hey, guy, I love pink flamingos. But how are you going to feed the world? How are you going to feed the world?" Can I be honest? I don't love that question. No, not because we already produce enough calories to more than feed the world. 1 billion people will go hungry today. 1 billion, that's more than ever before. Because of gross inequalities in distribution, not tonnage. Now, I don't love this question because it's determined the logic of our food system for the last 50 years. Feed grain to herbivores. Pesticides to monocultures, chemicals to soil, chicken to fish. And all along, agribusiness has simply asked, if we're feeding more people more cheaply, how terrible could that be? That's been the motivation, it's been the justification, it's been the business plan of American agriculture. We should call it what it is, a business in liquidation. A business that's quickly eroding ecological capital that makes that very production possible. That's not a business, and it is agriculture.
Can agribusiness and the kind of food production that you advocate, can they coexist?
Yeah. I mean, can you have industrial size with the kind of sustainability practices of a Beth La Palma? I think the answer is yes. I don't think that size is a determining factor. I think what's a determining factor is the mindset. You know, what's the mindset? And that's why I think chefs play and people who care about food play such an important role here, because we can be arbiters for what the mindset should be. And the mindset, if you're really truly after great food and not just cheap calories and bad nutrition, if you're after something that tastes good and that's good for us and that's good for the community, we can demand it through farmers like Miguel. And again, I think this is a much wider discussion than just fish. I think it applies to everything we eat.
Our breadbasket is threatened today, not because of diminishing supply, but because of diminishing resources. Not by the latest combine and tractor invention, but by fertile land. Not by pumps, but by fresh water. Not by chainsaws, but by forests. And not by fishing boats and nets, but by fish in the sea. Want to feed the world? Let's start by asking, how are we going to feed ourselves? Or better, how can we create conditions that enable every community to feed itself? To do that, don't look at the agribusiness model for the future. It's really old and it's tired. It's high on capital, chemistry, and machines. And it's never produced anything really good to eat. Instead, let's look to the ecological model. That's the one that relies on 2 billion years of on-the-job experience. Look to Miguel, farmers like Miguel, farms that aren't worlds unto themselves, farms that restore instead of deplete, farms that farm extensively instead of just intensively, farmers that are not just producers, but experts in relationships. Because they're the ones that are experts in flavor, too. And if I'm going to be really honest, they're a better chef than I'll ever be. You know, I'm okay with that. Because if that's the future of good food, it's going to be delicious. Thank you.
Dan Barber, he's the executive chef and co-owner of Blue Hill and Blue Hill at Stone Barns. To find out more about Dan's farm and Miguel's fish farm in Spain, go to ted.npr.org. And you can watch dozens more TED Talks about food, glorious food. Go to ted.com. Our program is produced by Jeff Rogers, Megan Kane, and Sam Greenspan, with help from Jeffrey Jones. Special thanks to our partners at TED, Chris Anderson, June Cohen, Janet Lee, Emily McManus, and Darren Triff. Also, thanks to NPR's Eric Newsom. I'm Allison Stewart. You've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.